And from Subaru, featuring the all-new three-row Ascent, with seating for up to eight and a choice of second-row captain's chairs. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Learn more at Subaru.com.
I'm Kristen Bingham from Indianapolis, and I'm a mother of two. There are things that I've learned from Bright by Text that I didn't get from the parenting books I read previously because I wasn't quite at that stage yet with my first. Just like the little, you know, games they suggest to play with your baby. I feel like Bright by Text is a little bit more, I don't know, creative in a way.
Learn more about Bright by Text at wfyi.org/bright. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for NPR's Fresh Air comes from listeners who donate to WFYI and from Comcast Business, providing a gig-speed network that gets business done. Comcast Business, beyond fast. More at ComcastBusiness.com. And from Nick Baker Law, reminding you not to text and drive. More information at 317-456-7889 or InjuryLawIndiana.com. You're listening to WFYI-FM Indianapolis, simulcast in partnership with Indiana State University and Franklin and Wabash Colleges on WISU-FM Terre Haute, WFCI-FM Franklin, and WNDY-FM Crawfordsville.
I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk to the woman who is at the center of so many of our discussions about schools, about students, and about the future of Indiana's young people, State Superintendent of Public Instruction Jennifer McCormick. We're going to talk about her future and that of education here in Indiana. Please join the conversation. You can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today with Indiana Superintendent of Public Instruction, Jennifer McCormick. I should welcome you to the program. I think it's your first visit here. It's good to have you here.
Thank you. It is my first visit.
And I would invite our listeners to join the conversation if you've got questions for Superintendent McCormick. Please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So I think probably the easiest way to do this is get the elephant, you know, that's in the room out of the way.
What would that be?
And yeah, you announced recently that you wouldn't be running for another term. And it's, you know, 2 years ahead of the time when you'd be on the ballot. I figure we'll get that out of the way early so that we can talk about other stuff down the line. Could you talk a little bit about what your reasoning was, why you decided to not just decide not to run again, but to announce it as early as you did?
Yeah. So first of all, you know, that was a very difficult decision, and it still is. It comes with a lot of emotion, and it's bittersweet. But I would say when I got into the race and threw my hat in the ring for state superintendent, I did so because as a local superintendent, I was very aware of it. Things were very disrupted. People were distracted, and I thought we can do better. Our students deserve better. So when I got into office, my charge was to calm the field down, calm the situation down, try to get the politics out of it as much as possible. And I quickly learned that you have to have a willingness from all parties to do that. And it has been a real struggle to see that.
Yeah, I know you have said several times that you were naive when you came
in. I was.
And that the whole process has been an education for mm-hmm. you. Could you talk about what some of the lessons learned along the way have been?
So having been a local superintendent and principal, I was always very systemic about efficiency, and I have little patience for when things become very muddled because of time, because of resources, because of what's on the line, and that's students. And so what I quickly learned here at the state level is there's more patience from others regarding inefficiency and muddling up the system for whatever reason. And so it's been very difficult given my background in K-12, where every penny counts and our time is valuable and you've got kids on the line, that my background wasn't meshing well with the current system and how politics is an interesting game. A lot of things happen for a lot of different reasons, but that efficiency piece is huge for me just because, again, we've got a lot on the line.
What was the biggest surprise or shock for you when you came into office?
Yeah, I was naive in thinking there would be a big willingness to calm things down, to break down the barriers, to get the layers of governance out of it, to try to really bring back that local flair and to, all pedal in the same direction and paddle in the same direction. So I was very naive in thinking there would be this big willingness across the board to make that happen. And what I quickly learned was not everybody had that same willingness.
So let me, you said a couple of minutes ago that one of your goals was to try to get the politics out of the process. There's no other way to say it. I mean, it is somewhere between 55% and 70% education spending, 55% and 70% of the state's budget when there's that much money involved, not to mention education of our young people, which parents and all sorts of other people really care about. Is it at all possible to get politics out of it?
I think it's possible to get some of the politics out of it. And I know when we're over the half the state's budget, we're going to receive a lot of attention, and rightfully so. But I think, too, I was approaching it from using data, from using true facts to get to, breaking down some of those barriers. And what I quickly learned are special interest groups are pretty loud. Mm-hmm. And so that's the piece of the politics that could be controlled more. The layer of governance that I have seen in other states that are a lot less than what Indiana has surrounding education, that can be controlled. So can all politics be taken out of it? No, but there's a lot of it in Indiana that could be better controlled.
What makes Indiana, because my observation is you're right, that just about every state in the country has some version of the education wars going on. Mm-hmm. But the fighting is much more savage here than it is in many other places. You've sort of been at the center of that. In some ways, you're the rope in the game of tug of war, mm-hmm. or have been. What is it about Indiana that has made that the case?
It's obvious that you can't lead anything if you don't have followers. And for us, those followers have to be leaders. And for the department, that means our K-12 partners, our pre-K, our higher ed, and we need that partnership. But, that means you have to be a good listener and you have to really look at, the data, look at what's happening, what's going well, what's not going well. But if you're not impacting the classroom, what are you truly impacting? But on the other end of that, you have people making policy, people making rules, people who have agendas that are very singular item agendas pulling at you. Mm-hmm. And so to try to balance that and do what's right for kids is very tricky. I'll be the first one to admit that. But again, it goes to, I approached it more commonsensical as far as let's use the data, let's use role models, let's use best practice and to move Indiana. But you also have the other end of that where you have a lot of people that feel like they know best, whether that's based on any particular data, research, or anything in between, because of a lot of special groups pulling at them.
Who are some of those special groups?
There are several in Indiana. They have deep pockets, and I won't get into all of that, but there are several.
Well, and you can balance it if you want to. I mean, pick one because,
The Indiana Chamber is a perfect example of that. They hold a lot of clout and a lot of power over our General Assembly. They put out priorities, and they're very vocal about that. And there are times I agree with them and times I disagree with them, but they do. In Indiana, at least at the State House, they hold a lot of power. But there are several groups in Indiana that are similar to that.
Were you able to make any headway in talking with them and saying, okay, I hear you, but this is what, there's this evidence on the other side that would suggest what you're pushing doesn't really make sense.
You know, what's interesting is we put out the same time we did our legislative priorities and revealed those, mm-hmm. we put out our accomplishments and we aligned them to the governor's pillars to show, look, we're working right along with you. There are some areas that aren't aligned to his pillars, like literacy, for example, but kind of indirectly it very much is. But we've been very noisier about that. But the work that has been related to his pillars, we showed that to say, look at the accomplishments despite the hard barriers that have been put into place. And if there weren't those barriers, imagine what could get accomplished. So we've gotten a lot done and we will continue to work really, really hard. But there are just parts of that that make it very difficult to get anything accomplished.
What did you think when you say the accomplishments? What do you consider your biggest accomplishments in the nearly 2 years now that you've been in office?
So when we got in, we wanted to calm the situation down, and we did that through communication and transparency. I would say through our reorganization of the department, we've done a great job of being a better resource and service to our local schools. We are actually returning calls and returning emails, and we monitor all of that for customer service because they're trying to get it done in the classroom. We have to be responsive. We've restructured a whole assessment system, which is a huge lift for the state. We've looked at accountability. We submitted an ESSA plan that's one of the best in the nation. We have over 2,000 new teachers who have received licenses, the highest it's been in 10 years. I mean, the list goes on. We're putting together a great package for social-emotional learning in Indiana because we know it's School Safety Week and that relationship piece is huge. We've put that into place. So there are a lot of accomplishments that have been nationally recognized and at the state level and certainly at the local level, and we will continue to add to that.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with Indiana Superintendent of Public Instruction, Jennifer McCormick. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So let me ask, how much did, the change, the decision to make the superintendent's position an appointed one rather than elected one play into your decision not to run again?
From the beginning when that conversation started, which got louder when I came in, but it's been for decades that conversation's been going on. So it's not new. It's, I think, how it's being handled. I understand, especially now being in the position I'm in, how you have to have some type of alignment with the governor's office and my position because there are limited resources. You have initiatives trying to get done. You don't want there to cause confusion and unnecessary disruption in the local schools. And the business world needs to be a great partner with that. So I understand that. However, I'm also very passionate that you need to have people's voice. You know, that's, we're over half of the state's budget. Most of our 1.2 million students, over 90%, are sitting in public schools. I think having voice of our citizens is extremely important in what my position is. But again, I understand it has to be somewhat aligned to the governor. There are ways to do that. You can have still an appointed position and look at the state board and do something with the elections there like other states have done. So you still have the people's voice in education. There's ways to do it and still ensure that the governor has some type of say-so in the where the education is going in the state. Because I do understand he's ultimately responsible for the entire state, and that includes 100% of the budget. So I understand both sides. What's happening now is it's becoming a louder conversation and it's becoming very disruptive. And I have no patience for that. It's not the topic, it's how it's being handled. So in order to calm that down right before legislative session was one of the reasons for my early release of my decision not to run again, so that hopefully we can get that out of the way, cut down another barrier, and let us do what we need to do for kids.
If it were your decision alone, would you make it an appointed position or would you have it remain an elective one?
You know, I've tried to think of that from the governor's standpoint. If I were the governor of Indiana, which certainly I'm not, obviously, but if I were, I would want someone in that position who I could make sure that we were aligned. And right now, regardless, we are mainly aligned about 90% of what we're doing. I am aligned to the governor's initiatives. But we've been in situations where that's not the case. So I understand and would probably do what they're trying to do as far as making that position look, you know, more of an appointment. But I would also take a look at the state board to look at how does that work with the director position? How does that work with the members? And what can we do for the people's voice in that situation?
If you're just joining us, we are talking with Indiana Superintendent of Public Instruction, Jennifer McCormick. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Margaret has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Margaret, you're on the line.
Thank you. I'm calling to thank both Superintendent McCormick and you for addressing the issue of, through her experience, the special interest who she found through her experience of kind of blocking and making it difficult to move forward. I don't even need to rename this special interest, but I am very, very grateful both for the question as well as the direct answer, because as a parent as well as a citizen activist, over time, that specific special interest has misled and been overwhelmingly a blockade to just regular people and teachers trying to work on behalf of kids, as well as we've been able to demonstrate costs savings, but it got wiped out by that special interest that has a huge budget as well as professional staff, and over the decades it has often not served public education well. It serves business interests,
Margaret,
not community.
I hate to cut you off, but we're coming up on a break, and I want to give Superintendent McCormick a chance to respond.
I just want to thank you both.
Thank you very much.
So, first of all, thank you, Margaret, for your comment, ma'am. I appreciate that. And I know there are folks, too, that part of the issue is you have people who are ill-informed or misinformed, and there are a lot of people that take advantage of that. And it is really hard to educate people on the educational system of Indiana. But I do appreciate your comment, and I appreciate that you're staying informed on Indiana's education.
If you are just joining us, we're talking with Indiana Superintendent of Public Instruction, Jennifer McCormick. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today with Indiana Superintendent of Public Instruction, Jennifer McCormick. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or you can do what a listener named Jesse has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Jesse, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello. What's on your mind?
Mr. Kroll, Mrs. McCormick. I guess I just want to just kind of jump right into my question. We have children that attend Vigo County School Corporation, and there's recently been several things in the news about high-level administration, corruption, bribery, going over the past couple years. While individual people do make individual choices, I believe that it kind of also lends to a lack of accountability, which has now settled into the school corporation. So with that said, there's currently the new superintendent is inviting the community to kind of just some sit downs and some discussions. And my question to you, Mrs. McCormick, is what would be some important questions to ask in these meetings to, first of all, increase, I think, accessibility of parents to what's going on in the school, and then also to, you know, try to, I guess, address from a policy standpoint how to get an increased communication from the schools to the parents, because that's been an ongoing issue with us as parents having kids in the school corporation here.
Thanks very much for the call and the questions, Jesse.
So, first of all, thank you for your question, Jesse. I know Vigo County's been through a rough, really, a year and a half, and they are trying to mend, and I do give credit to the new superintendent. I know it's been tough on everyone involved and the community. So I commend you for asking questions. I think that is just critical. Having been a superintendent, I wish more people would have asked questions, to be honest. My question to the superintendent, if I were you, I would ask about ongoing efforts in that community. Communication. So calling you together for the first time to kind of explain where you are in the moment, but how is that going to continue? The other thing to keep in mind with the transparency is Indiana and the entire nation, but how we've approached in Indiana with our new ESSA plan, which is Every Student Succeeds Act, it calls for an enormous amount of transparency, both academically and fiscally. And all of that is available to taxpayers, to community members, and is accessible. Now, the fiscal piece is a little bit more delayed, but there are other ways to get to that information. Attending board member meetings is another way to really stay informed and just ask good questions. But I think Vigo would welcome, you know, that question from community members on how to stay informed and what are those mechanisms put into place now in Vigo County for that continued conversation. So good for you to ask those questions and stay informed.
We've gotten a question from a listener who didn't want to go on the air. It says, can Dr. McCormick address the issues of school choice in Indiana, the good, the bad, and the ugly?
So time's up. So school choice in Indiana is very interesting.
Yeah, touching the third, we're actually touching the third rail here.
Yeah,
right now.
So school choice in Indiana is interesting. And having been a local superintendent, I will say I was at a traditional public school and I did open our doors. We were Ellis Island. We were come one, come all. And I firmly believe that if we had something to offer for a student, great. If we were not a good fit, come in and I would help you find a good fit. So I believe in that for kids. Something to pay attention to and to watch that I think is where we're struggling as a state is I'm not choice for the sake of choice. I think if we're going to have choice for kids, it needs to be quality choice. So that means accountability. It means transparency. It means being very smart with our policies and our practices. But I also am very cognizant of that we have 1.2 million students. The majority of those students who take advantage of choice, by far the largest, would be a transfer from public traditional schools to public traditional schools, which also brings some struggles financially to some of our districts. But I do believe in it's got to be a good fit for our students, but it needs to be quality. I also have our part of our legislative priorities have been very vocal in the last 2 years about that transparency piece, making sure that our citizens, our parents, our community members, and our schools understand what is happening within those schools, what's happening with the fiscal within those schools, and being very prudent about the finances that are running through many of our choice schools. A big piece that's been I've been very vocal about here of late is for some of our choice schools, they exclude certain students, and I do not agree with that. I think that is just outrageous to even think about that. So we are saying if you're taking taxpayer money, you should be open to an individual. If you're taking choice, then you need to have it open. There should not be an exclusionary provision allowed.
This is probably the point in the program where I do one of my standard disclaimer disclosures and say that earlier in my career, I spent 6 years as the executive director of what is now the ACLU of Indiana, and we had a position staked out on school choice. I don't like to withhold anything from the audience and in the sake of that kind of transparency. But with that background in mind, as both a journalist and then in those years, I've seen the evolution of this debate, and I think you're kind of alluding to it. Originally, when school choice was presented as an option and a way to reform schools, the goal was to promote increased efficiency and to open the doors, and we would see greater results from this because market forces would create improvement. Now, increasingly, I hear from leaders such as Representative Boehning that it's not so much that as it is, this is a kind of entitlement for parents that, you know, they deserve this. They deserve to have the right to give their children, to put their children in the educational situation they want. First is that sort of summary of where this debate has gone, a fair one, and what do you think of the place it's in now?
It's interesting because I think you're exactly right. To set the urgency, that message has been very fluid. We went from it's to really give choice to our underserved, underprivileged. Then it went into, you know, where there's an F school and you have to attend public school before you can leave that after, you know, you have to at least give it a try per se. So it's kind of evolved into what it is now. But as we're watching the data, and I go, silly me, you know, to watch data and watch trends and be responsible with fiscal money. But when we watch that, it becomes very clear that the students who took advantage of choice, which was first set in motion for the underserved, underprivileged, what we're seeing is a huge uptick in our white suburban students who probably have access to pretty good schools already, public schools. And so that's what we're seeing. But then the argument becomes, well, it should just be choice for the sake of choice because everybody pays taxpayer dollars. And when we have that argument as far as is it choice for choice, because not everybody really does have choice. So it's an evolving conversation. It can be frustrating at times, but I'm also watching carefully as a department. We do a report every year of who exactly is taking advantage of choice. And so that's been interesting for Indiana to watch. We're years down the road in this compared to some states, and we get a lot of calls saying, what should we do? And I'm saying, you know, a lot of times it's out of that person's hand who's making the call, but we always say you need to watch the data, be transparent, and have your message tight.
So this is a bigger question. Obviously, the battle over school choice has consumed much of the state's attention for close to 30 years now. Are we fighting the wrong fight there? I mean, most of the evidence would suggest that really, at least that I have seen, that the biggest reforms we could make that would improve educational performance and make school much more satisfying piggyback more on the tremendous advances we have made in figuring out brain development and the ways that young people learn, that we really should be restructuring every classroom and figuring out more entry points. And we're not doing that because we're so busy fighting about, you know, vouchers.
Yeah, and I've also had that conversation. Those numbers aren't moving a great deal, and I know those schools who are losing dollars are continuing to watch that. But I've also talked to a lot of our choice people and said, you know, let's have a bigger conversation about curriculum instruction and how to be smart with assessment. Let's that be the focus. Also, let's have a conversation about we're in a crisis here still with our teachers. We're under 2,000 emergency permits. 88% of them who responded to our survey said pay matters. We are losing 35% of our teachers within 3 years. That's a crisis. We should be having a conversation. So school choice will always be lingering there as a fiscal piece of the conversation. But I agree with you. There are topics that are much more worth our time right now as far as how are we going to serve the students and serve them well.
How much of it, because you're referring to the teacher shortage, which has been an ongoing problem here in Indiana. It is elsewhere, too, but here it seems to be, if not particularly acute, at least among the most acute in the state. When I talk with teachers, yes, they mention the pay, but they also mention something else that probably you're smiling at me already. Mm-hmm. I think you know what's coming. It is they don't feel respected. They don't feel that their voices are heard. They're the ones who spend all the time at the front line, and they feel like they're the one part of this discussion that never gets heard. Is that what you hear as well, and what can we do about it?
Yeah, we are working on that. We've tried to do more teacher celebrations. We've tried to get out and tell our story. Here's the other piece of it that needs to be told is that classroom's tough. And to pretend it's not or to paint a different picture is not doing anybody justice, including the students. You know, it's a complex job, and it's extremely rewarding. I did it. I lived it. I understand it. But it is a tough situation now to be in many of our classrooms across the state. And then when you do that, you expect, you know, not everybody needs a pat on the back, but some respect is the least that we can do for them. So if the pay can't come up to the level we need it, obviously many of them are saying, look, can we just bring back a respect to the profession instead of making us the enemy? Can we embrace our partnerships and move forward? So that is a big piece that I hear across the state, no matter where I'm at.
We are talking about the state of schools with Indiana Superintendent of Public Instruction, Jennifer McCormick. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Trish has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Trish, you're on the air.
Well, thank you, Mr. Call. Dr. McCormick, thank you for your service. Now that it appears that the superintendent is going to be in an appointed position, would you like to comment on an idea that is circulating that perhaps the Superintendents Association and or the School Board Association or Association of School Business Officials should have a voice in selecting members of the State Board of Education?
Thanks very much for the call, Trish.
Yeah, thank you, Trish. I appreciate that comment. And yes, we have started to look at models from other states that who have done it successfully in how that state board membership is made up. And so in Indiana, obviously, it's heavy with appointments from the governor. Then you have one from the Speaker of the House and one from the pro tem on the Senate side, and then the state superintendent. So it would make a lot of sense if the state board members, if they're down the road in Indiana, that's where that people voice or the professional organizations could be of great help. It has been frustrating because as we've had openings on the state board, we have been very diligent to do just what you're saying, to go out, talk to the professional organizations, make our calls, be smart about finding people who are good thought partners, who are just out for not political purposes, but for the sake of kids, and offer those names to those who are making those appointments. And we didn't have much success with that the last round, but we will continue to do that. But it does make a lot of sense, and trying to set things up for success for kids on what's practical, but yet can still move things forward. A lot of times people will start pigeoning people into, okay, they're just traditionalists and they want the same old, same old. I'm not seeing that right now. There's a sense of urgency in the states moving, and our professional organizations are coming right along with those efforts. But I think we have to be smart and thoughtful, but I think that is a really good idea that we are having discussion about.
Do you think, you've mentioned a couple of times that the State Board of Education would be a good place to bring the people's voice in. I mean, if it were in your power, would you make that elective now and say, okay, that's the way because there may be a possibility where you have a governor down the line, we'll exclude Eric Holcomb from the discussion, we'll move it forward, where he makes some decisions regarding education that people disagree with, and they need a mechanism between elections to register their displeasure.
Yeah, I think that would be something that as a governor, he or she should really do a deep dive and look at that. So I think that is a great area that other states have found success where that does become more of a people's voice elected board. Our board is large, but many of them are. But I think it makes sense. So as far as how you move that power away from my position, per se, there are still ways to get the people's voice in education.
We've gotten a question from a caller who did not want to go on the air, who wants to know, why are we not naming special interest groups? And in fairness, I should point out, you did name one, the Indiana Chamber of Commerce. I'll tell you what, I'll play devil's advocate here. The other major player historically has been the Indiana State Teachers Association. Have they been contributors to the sort of the logjam or the ongoing strife?
What I will say about the teachers' professional organizations, we don't always agree, but we have worked very well with them. So, they come to the table, they work with our legislative partners, and in the end, there are times where we do disagree. But I have found them to be pretty good partners. When I was a local superintendent, I had a good rapport with my local organization. And a lot of that is you're not always going to agree. But coming to the table and being respectful, I have not found that to be overly problematic.
And how about all of the groups? And there's like an alphabet soup of them these days. I can't go through all of them devoted to either they'll that they first would say they were devoted to school choice, but once after that became politically divisive, they moved to the more neutral sounding education reform. How about the education reform groups, many of which are heavily funded with corporate dollars?
Yeah, a power has a lot of money backing it, and many of our professional organizations don't have a lot of money. So that's where we are right now, although they have some clout at the State House and they have some power, but the authority or a lot of the power at the State House is across the nation. It's not just state money, it's national money that's being pushed in. So again, power has a lot of money behind it, and if you follow those dollars, you usually follow who's pushing things.
Is there any organization that has the power that the state chamber does when it comes to education?
I would say there are a couple in Indiana that have power. Many of them are linked to the choice movements. But, you know, and they obviously are putting their money to what they believe, and that's okay. That's what they're there for. But at times, it's really hard to operate from my office.
Was dealing with them and dealing with all of that the hardest part of the job for you?
It was difficult. Yes, I will say that was a piece of it that was really hard, just because of the initiatives of you take 10 steps forward, and because of certain things, you take 5 steps back. And like I said, our impressive list of things we got done is there. Anybody can see it, but we could have got, I mean, there's a lot more to get done. There are barriers that shouldn't be up that are at times put up.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with Indiana Superintendent of Public Instruction Jennifer McCormick about her decision not to run again, but more importantly about the state of education here in Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today with Indiana Superintendent of Public Instruction, Jennifer McCormick, about the state of Indiana schools and her decision not to run for re-election in a couple of years. If you have a question or you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So I got to ask, given the frustrations and, you know, the politics and all of that that you encountered once you got into the job, do you regret making the decision to make the race? I mean, are you sorry you did it, or no?
No, I'm not. You know, it was a sacrifice for my family. I have a supportive husband who's a teacher and has been in education for a while, long-term coach. So he's been around in education and was, you know, very supportive of my decision. My family and my dad's been super supportive. And my son, who's off to college right now, I mean, it was really a family decision. And so I don't regret it. I've learned a great deal. I feel like I can be a much better educator based on what I've learned. I've been exposed to things that I wouldn't have been as far as learning practices, learning models, people, great thinkers that maybe I wouldn't have been in my other job. So I don't regret it. Again, I have a great team at the department. I give them a ton of credit, and I've met some great people who are doing great work in the field. So do I regret it? No. I mean, it's one of those you learn, you grow, and you move on to continue to serve kids.
What's the most valuable lesson you've picked up along the way here from this past nearly 2 years, or really going back to even running in the campaign, because campaigns are learning experiences too?
Yeah, you know, one thing that I've really personally just struggled with that I've had to become better at is probably patience. At the local level, as a teacher, as a principal, as a superintendent, if we wanted something done, boy, we could make it happen and make it happen fast. This has been a really trying on patience, and that takes a lot of listening, a lot of strategizing, a lot of systems thinking. So really the need for that patience has really stretched me. Government moves extremely slow, except for what I say, bad news and rumors. Mm-hmm. But that has been a challenge for me personally, and I've had to become comfortable more with just being being patient, keep the hard work going, hitting the ground hard, but just being patient and good things will happen.
What parts of the job are you not going to miss?
Some of the political parts of it, that when I know something is not what's good for kids and it's either forced upon us or it's being done regardless, that is very frustrating. And I struggle with that just because that's not who I am. And I stay true to myself. I have a team that will stay true to kids. And I tell them all the time, we stay true to ourselves and stay true to our morals. And we're going to do what's best and do the right thing. But sometimes that's out of my authority when things are pushing in all different directions where you just doesn't feel it's going to be what's best for kids.
What's an example of one of those things that's being pushed that's not good for kids?
Recently, a good example of, and I wouldn't say it's not good for kids, it's probably there's a better way to do it in a lot of regards. So we've been down the road of school safety at School Safety Week. I know I've been asked a lot about a lot of school safety measures in Indiana. We are big ones to believe that the local school makes the best decision on school safety. There should be some basic threshold of school safety that is a basic expectation. But beyond that, the needs of IPS look very different from the needs of a school in Randolph County. That's just the reality of it. So give us the resources, give us those relationships and the partners, and let us do our thing. And of late, there's been a big push on one size fits all. Mm-hmm. Let's do different initiatives and let's get it out there. And I've been receiving those text messages and those phone calls from superintendents saying, well, what are you thinking? And that's not me thinking that's not our program. And so those are the times where it becomes very difficult, where I know at the local level, the impact that will or will not have when we are strapped for resources, could those been used differently? So that's where it becomes quite frustrating that, you know, the system is what it is, and I understand and respect people's authority, but it becomes tough when you're not in those conversations, but you're having to defend some of them.
And I'm going to ask a question basically to preempt the 57 calls we will get in the next couple of minutes. Is arming teachers a solution or a bad idea?
I think it's a really bad idea. So there are some districts that, I mean, if there are guns in schools, obviously we have great resource officers, we have law enforcement, there's a way to do that and be smart about it. There are, I think, two districts in Indiana that are looking at arming educators because of response time, because of where they are. And that is at a high, high training. But just a blanket statement, hey, let's arm teachers and hope for the best, boy, that is a really, really bad idea. I mean, I had teachers and I was one of them that I had no business carrying a gun and teaching with a gun on my side or on my desk. I mean, that's just a bad idea.
We have gotten an email from a listener. Again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. This listener writes, many states have gone to using computer language coding classes as foreign language in high school. Why doesn't Indiana?
Yeah, and we are having those conversations about using different courses, not just for world language, but for what counts as a science credit, what counts as a math credit. We're trying to modernize the way we look at things. So that very conversation has been taking place. That would be our recommendation to the state board, and then the state board would have to approve it, and then we would implement. So the way that works is a little bit wonky at times, but it is a conversation that people are having. Now, some of our world language people don't love that conversation, but there are others who understand why at least we need to go to the table and talk about it.
Gotten a question from a listener named Gabriel via Facebook. And again, you can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Gabriel writes, with such a teacher shortage, why does the state make it so hard for a person with the education, experiences, and subjects that are in need to get in the classroom? Not everyone has the opportunity, desire to get a master's degree only to make $35,000 a year. Some states require only a BA or a BS in the subject matter. Seems like a lost opportunity to get life experience people in the classroom.
Yeah, you are singing my tune. So we have worked on flexibility with licensing. We've opened up 58 of our high school courses on who can teach those, 4 of our courses at the middle level. We are opening up flexibility on who can teach what, but getting people licensed is tricky. We have 2 mechanisms that are kind of alternative type of from the traditional programs in workplace specialists and career specialists. However, you have to work in the vocational area for many hours. Sometimes that equates to 5 years. And so we're saying that's way too long, because I know there are people that could get in that classroom with the support of pedagogy that we can offer at the local level. Let's get them in the classroom, get them support, because if not, what's happening is we're cutting programs, You know, we're cutting out credit opportunities and course opportunities because of this, because of just the system. So we're working hard. We worked with the legislator last year. We got a little bit of movement. Then they backed off at the end. We're trying to, we'll go at them again. We need that flexibility, many of the same flexibility that our charter schools have, but we don't allow our traditional public schools to have. And we are really battling to get that done.
I've also got a question from a listener who didn't want to go on the air. Who says, and again, if you want to call us and ask your question, the number is 866-476-3881. This listener asked, what is being done to extend choices to rural areas for charter schools?
So the rural schools are interesting. The rural areas, there aren't a lot of choices. Some have more traditional public choices. Some have more choices determining a platform, whether they're online courses or traditional courses. The access to online is greater, but the access to a choice per se as far as establishment of a charter, many of our charter school authorizers and partners aren't moving into those areas, and sometimes that's because of need, because of the demand isn't there. So there are a lot of reasons for that. We are not prohibiting that from happening, but there are just not a lot of the charter authorizers or people who run those schools that are interested in going into some of those areas right now.
Is some of it that there's just not enough density to make it worthwhile?
Yeah, the demand's not there. There's not enough people. Yeah, a lot of that has to do with that. I mean, it's expensive. School's expensive. And I'll be honest, some of our folks who get into that charter world are paying attention to those dollars. So, yeah, part of it is there are a lot of reasons for it, but money has to do a great deal with it.
So I want to come back. I asked you a few minutes ago, what are the things you're not going to miss about the job? What are the things that you are going to miss about it?
The people, the partners, learning, you know, our team. We put together a great team at the department, and I stand by them, and I will miss many of those people and working with them. The partners at the local level I'll still have contact with because I'm sure my passions will take me to still interact with something to do with students. So I will miss that piece. I love school visits. That's exciting, and that's why we're here. Working with our congressional delegation, I have really enjoyed that piece of it across the board. I don't care if you're Republican, Democrat, or otherwise. I mean, we open our door, and they have done the same. So I will miss that piece of it.
Gotten an email from a listener named Chip. And again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Chip writes, public school advocates, which is a son of a public high school English teacher, I am an advocate, often talk of how there is an organized effort funded by the Koch brothers via Americans for Prosperity to dismantle public education as we know it. The current state of Indiana's public teacher morale and shortage makes me think, there is some truth there. What is your opinion? Is there an organized national effort to dismantle public education?
I don't think it's a secret that you have folks that across the nation that are not fans of public education. They don't have a whole lot of good to say about public education and don't make it a secret. So I don't think that is new news. I do think there are groups out there that would not be upset if we had to shut our doors and revamp and come up with a whole new system. But is that realistic? No. I believe in some of our, you know, the efforts of our public schools. Many of them are doing a great job. Do some need to improve? Absolutely. But do I think there are people across the nation that would be happy to see us close our doors? Yes, I do. And they don't make a secret about it. But as far as from my seat and as far as from my background as a public school person, my son went to public education, my husband, my family, and that's who we are. Realistically, I don't think that's ever not going to be an option. And our charge is to get as we want to be the choice. We want to be in this competitive environment. We want to be the choice for students, and we will work hard to be that.
So you've got a little more than 2 years left to serve as the state school's chief. What are your goals for that 2 years?
I want to make sure that when I leave, that our students are provided with better opportunities, that our teachers are loaded with resources and support, that we're still having the conversation about what our profession should be and the respect that should follow. I want to empower our leaders, and not knowing what that next step will be like if it's an appointment, to make sure that we're ready for those next steps and just leave it in a better place that honestly we found it. And I can honestly say right now, I can walk walk away today and say we absolutely did that. But the opportunities and access for students is the first priority.
So let's assume possibly that a time machine could be invented here. And the Jennifer McCormick who is sitting with me in the studio right now could speak to the Jennifer McCormick who is getting ready to run for state superintendent of public instruction 2.5, 3 years ago. What would you say to that Jennifer McCormick based on what you've learned here?
Probably remind myself, because I had some really good advice going into it, to it's an everyday reminder, stay true to yourself and don't sell yourself out, because it's easy to do. I've seen it done across the board. So stay true to yourself, stay student focused. The advice I would give is just, you know, remain, again, student focused and you're keep an eye on educators, because when you do that, you are staying student focused. Do a lot of listening and be prepared for that patience piece that I talked about, mm-hmm. and really be cognizant of that. But that's probably what I would tell myself at this okay. point.
Are there any decisions or things you've done along the way in your time in office that you regret or you wish you could take back or do again?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are times where you make a decision based on the information you have at that moment. And I'd like some redos, like a mulligan. You know, that's not possible. But what you do is you grow from that. You grow others from that. And you try to do better in your next decision making. And so I'm not at all perfect, but I will try to continue to get better. Again, I take it very seriously that, you know, we do have 1.2 million students who are moving through the system. They got one shot at it. They got, you know, it, for me, it's a job, it's a profession, it's a career, it's a passion. But for them, they've got one shot at K-12, and I want to make it the best experience we can. So that it's my responsibility to be the best I can be.
So I'm going to ask this question in the spirit of I've made a personal vow to myself that I plan to vote for the next public official who says, oh, yeah, I made a mistake. I learned from it, and this is what I learned from it. That shows, in fact, okay, growth is possible, even among those who hold elected office. What was one of the ones that you'd like a mulligan on that you'd like to do over?
Well, I'll be honest, there are a lot. I mean, you know, when you're coming in new to a state elected position, I mean, there are a lot of things I would like to do over. Probably the first one right out of the gate that I can think of in January, when I was first elected, how we approached the legislative session. I was green. I didn't know any better. Probably would like a do over in that. I wasn't as good a listener as I should have been. And I didn't have my facts presented the way I should have. I presented them as an educator. I needed to present those to people who didn't know the world of education. And so we've learned from that and we did get better. But that's what I can think of right out of the gate, staffing wise. You know, I was given some advice that at the moment, it sounded really like good advice in some of our hirings that I think back at that and I maybe would have made some different decisions. But I'm really confident in the team we have today and what we're doing in the moment. But you learn, and that's part of who we are. And so I'm not perfect again. We've made a lot of mistakes along the way, but boy, do we get some things right as well.
What's the next chapter for you?
It's a great question. Did my husband call you?
No, but my guess is he's listening. So.
He should be busy teaching. Yeah. My son should be busy
in class. Yeah, and the podcast, though, is there forever.
There you go. Yeah. So I don't know those next steps. You know, right now I'm just focused on what we need to get done at the department, and I will stay committed to that. And I am a get-it-done kind of person with our team. And so whatever it is, I'm sure it'll impact students. It'll impact teachers. I love a challenge. So if that's going back into a district that's a challenge, then I welcome that. If that's going into higher ed or going into the business world, a lot of options, but I've got a lot of time to consider that and pause and think about that as well.
What are the things that appeal to you most? I mean, what will be the sort of criteria you use in making that decision?
Serving others. I mean, that's my passion. So I love to serve kids, and that's what I do well, and that's what I believe in, and serving educators and helping them get better. So, but beyond that, you know, if it's inside the educational arena, I'm very comfortable with that. But a lot of other areas also serve people. And so whatever it will be, I will continue to serve. Hopefully it's the state of Indiana, but again, it may be another state. And as long as I'm serving people, then that's where I'm comfortable, and that's what I do best.
Well, that probably is a good last word. I'd like to thank you. This has been a very frank conversation. Which is refreshing when dealing with elected officials.
Gets me in trouble.
Well, probably it will, and I'll apologize for that. Well, not really, because it's sort of my job. But I would invite you to come back, obviously, before you leave office as often as you would like, and that certainly when you get ready to make that next step, hope you come back and talk with us about it.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And I also would like to thank our listeners, as usual, for some really great questions and comments. It is wonderful to be able to do talk radio for people who pay this close attention and think this deeply about the issues. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neil Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.